I'm quite delighted and surprised to see people actually come back. I thought this material would be so hard that everybody would just say, the hell with all this. And one little caveat as I get started. What I'm talking about is first trying to set a historical framework, and we will gradually lead into philosophy and then into science. Now, I have read a lot of historians, and historians and people of faith often disagree. I will cite historians, but what I want to make sure is that when I do so, it is understood that I'm not trying to contradict any people of faith, and I'm certainly not trying to insult anyone. But off we go, because today what I want to talk about is the rise of the Islamic Empire in East. I have left up here the picture with which I ended yesterday, which is, and I will refer to on occasion today. Let's see, is this the right picture or not? No, it's the wrong picture, but so I want to, okay. This is the picture I wanted to really leave up. This is the picture of the whole Mediterranean basin in 650, and where the Arab Empire was beginning to grow. But here is all of the Byzantine Empire, and you can see it still exists in what is now Morocco and Algeria. It controls the south of Italy and the island of Sicily, and this little bit up here. There seem to be very few contemporary sources for the birth of Islam. We have really two sets of documents. The first is a set of biographies of Muhammad that appear to have been written about 150 years after his death. And so historians don't put a lot of veracity into them, in the same way that most of the Gospels in the New Testament are written well after the death of Jesus, and also are looked at with askance by lots of historians. The second set comes from non-Islamic sources, and it deals mainly with the invasions and incursions of the Arab armies, the creation of this new empire, and since it's history written by the losers, it is surprisingly, not surprisingly, unsympathetic. What we do seem to know is Muhammad was born around 570 and he died around 632. In 622, he escaped an assassination attempt and fled from Mecca to Medina, and this is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. He had great influence in the Arabian Peninsula and lots of adherents, but they seem to have returned to older ways. There was a period of apostasy after his death, as there was a struggle for the succession and the appointment of the second caliph. I think his name was Abu Bakr, but I'm not sure. There was a struggle as to whether the succession should be hereditary or whether it should be done in some different way. This has led eventually to the Sunni-Shia split. The succession was challenged by his cousin and son-in-law Ali, but accepted eventually for the sake of peace. But as the faith spread and armies were increasingly successful, more and more dissensions occurred, and so the third successor, the third caliph, was murdered, and Ali became the fourth caliph, but he too was murdered in 661. Before this, however, Arab armies had defeated the empire, and they had taken Jerusalem down here. The empire, the imperial forces, tried to hold on to Egypt, and they sent lots of extra troops to Alexandria, but that was futile, and Egypt fell to the Arabs by 641. They took Syria and eventually Cyprus, as we see, by 661. And by 674, Constantinople itself was seriously threatened. This is 650, as you can see. Arab armies had very significant fleets, but Constantinople was successfully defended by the use of what is called Greek fire. This is a petroleum product that the Byzantines spread on the water and set alight, and of course meant that wooden boats were destroyed. this Greek fighters' petroleum was obtained from the Caspian, which is up here somewhere. There you can see it. Mostly from this today is Azerbaijan, and Baku is still a source of considerable oil. In 680, at the Battle of Karbala in present-day Iraq, Ali's son Hussein was killed, and this was a very significant event in the Sunni-Shia split, which still resonates so powerfully today. Penetration westward by Arab armies continued, and they invaded Tunisia here, and there's Carthage. They conquered Carthage in 698. And then the indigenous Berber tribes here in North Africa were pretty good at resisting, but in the next 20 years, by 711, they too fell, and the Arabs then were poised to invade Europe by way of the Iberian Peninsula. After they conquered Spain, they crossed the Pyrenees and entered into France, up here, and eventually they kept going until they were defeated by a combined Frankish-Burgundian army under the control or direction of a Carolingian king called Charles. This battle was fought at a little, well, we'll get to it, there's a picture of it later, at a little town somewhere between the cities of Poitiers and Tours, and is called the Battle of Poitiers, or sometimes the Battle of Tours, since it's in between. This was fought in 732 and was the greatest extent to which Arab armies penetrated north into Europe. Because of the victory, the King Charles was given the name of the Hammer, which is Martel in Latin, and he's known to history as Charles Martel. The Arab conquest of Iberia, of course, marked the end of Christian influence and the end of this Visigothic kingdom here. North Africa had been the center of intellectual life for the Catholic Church before this, in particular St. Augustine lived there, and that, of course, was ended when the control passed to the Arab armies. Now, the threat of excommunication by bishops in the church was of great importance in this time, and the most important of these bishops was a man by the name of Isidore of Seville, who lived between 560 and 636. He wrote on a huge variety of subjects. For us, the most important is a collection of 20 volumes called the Etymologies, in which he tried to maintain as much as he could of the knowledge of the Greeks of the past. But this is a very fantastical work. It's not very serious, but it was the source for many centuries of basic knowledge from astronomy to medicine. Knowledge was kept alive primarily in the monasteries, and the works they studied were those of the Roman Pliny, of Boethius, of his contemporary Cassiodorus, who was also a senator under Theodoric, and of course Isidore of Seville. One of the characteristics of the split between East and West was in language. St. Augustine was fluent in Greek, as was Boethius. But by the time he was killed in 524, there was almost nobody left in Italy who spoke Greek. And that language was basically dead. In the East, in Constantinople and their territory, Latin was considered the language of barbarians to the West, and only Greek was spoken. But the Eastern Empire's inability to withstand the onslaught of these invading Arab armies led to a huge split between Eastern and Western Christianity, because this being the intellectual center of Christianity was gone. The Mediterranean was largely controlled either by pirates or by the Arab navies, and so there was very little communication between the East and in Constantinople and the West in Rome. There were down here mass conversions to Islam, except in the Nile Valley there are still significant Christian communities, which I talked about a little bit yesterday, and these remain in terms of the Coptic Church. Almost all of the troops of the imperial forces were involved in trying to resist the flow of Arab armies from into here, which meant that they took troops away from these territories in Italy, and eventually not the Arabs, but the Lombards from the north came down and occupied almost all of Italy, with the exception of the Pope in Rome and these little territories, Sicily and the Apulia and Calabria. But eventually this island also fell to the Arabs. Now, in European areas, which were completely out of the control of the out of the influence of the Byzantine Empire, such as Ireland, Europe east of the Rhine, Iceland, Scandinavia, they came into increasing contact with Christian forces, and there was a gradual conversion to Christianity. Whereas in the east, Slavs and Bulgars stopped fighting the Byzantines as they adopted the Byzantine version of Christianity. We have the earliest conversions to Christianity, those of the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, and the Franks, those happened without any historical record. But the later conversions, those of the Scandinavians, the Anglo-Saxons in Britain, the Germans east of the Rhine, these are all very well recorded in present times. In addition, for the Slavic peoples, it even led to the addition of an alphabet for what had previously been a spoken language, and this alphabet is attributed to St. Cyril, but history says it was created by his followers, and it, of course, it is still called the Cyrillic alphabet to this day. In the West, the evangelical tendency to spread Christianity was primarily based upon the institution of monasteries. Even though Augustine had created a monastery, a monastic movement at the end of the 4th century, it didn't really come into a strong thing in the West until St. Benedict created Monte Cassino in 530. He not only created this great monastery, which was tragically destroyed in the Second World War but has been rebuilt, but he also created the Rules of Benedict as a means of establishing order and structure for the monks who were there. This is an incredibly totalitarian, absolutist set of rules, and I will show you what they look like. Content with the meanest and worst of it, call himself and to think of himself as being the lowest of the low, not to speak except in reply to a superior, and to avoid laughter. These sound absolutely dreadful, but in fact they were milder than most of the rules which were already enforced in Italy or in Spain or in Gaul or in Ireland. And eventually, as we shall see, they were adopted universally when the Carolingian kings took over all of the Frankish Empire. Ireland was the first place outside the former Roman Empire to accept Christianity. And how and why it happened is completely unrecorded, although, of course, legend talks always about St. Patrick and the snakes and so forth, none of which is at all historically corroborable. However, as a non-Roman country, Latin was not spoken, but liturgical writings were, of course, in Latin, and so the Irish had to adopt a new language, a new culture, and a new religion. And this was such a had a huge influence at the time of Iron Age pagan traditions and the ancient Celtic language, all of which they had to change. And the shock of that change was so great that many monasteries were created in Ireland, and Ireland became a hyper-Catholic country with a very strong religious and educational tradition. But life was very harsh there, especially harsh in Ireland, and because of that, the Irish turned out to be exceptionally willing to be missionaries to the other countries to spread Christianity, and they were not afraid of the hardships and dangers involved in doing so. The first ministry and monastery they established outside of the island of Ireland was on the island close by of Iona, which is in the Inner Hebrides, just off the west coast of Scotland. But they also traveled extensively, and they were the people who brought Christianity to the Saxon cousins of the English. This spread of Christianity to these northern and eastern countries occurred at about the same time as the spread of Islam was taking place. Now, the land from the Pyrenees along the coast here is called, as you see, Aquitaine. And Gaul had this mostly up here, had been ruled by the Merovingian kings, of whom Clovis was the most famous. But by the end of the 7th century, they weren't doing very much, and so a strong family named the Arnulfings started to take control. The Arnulfings controlled this area called Austrasia here. You can see it is this is Belgium, this is Germany, etc., and this is mostly what today would be German, and it reaches up into the Netherlands up here. This part over here with Paris and so forth was called Neustria, and then we have Aquitaine. The strongman of the Austrasians was a king named Pippin II. When he died, the succession passed to his illegitimate son, Charles. And Charles conquered Neustria and much of Aquitaine. But during the time when he was doing this, the Arabs were making considerable incursions into Aquitaine. And the Duke of Aquitaine appealed to Charles for help, and which Charles did, and with a combined Frankish Burgundian army, as I said, this is where that battle was fought. There's Poitiers, there's the site of the battle, and that's the, as I said, the farthest incursion of Arab influence into Europe, and his designation, of course, as Charles Martel. The great historians of the 18th and 19th century, who had a great sense of drama, like to say that Charles Martel saved Europe for Christianity, but that, of course, seems to be in some doubt. However, from the 100 years from the birth of Muhammad in 632 to the Battle of Poitiers in 732, Arab armies had conquered a territory from the north of India, over about here, up to Iberia, a huge, huge swath of the earth. They were incredibly successful. After the Battle of Poitiers, Charles moved south into Provence and this area, which had been controlled by the Arabs, and conquered Marseille and took back Marseille and Avignon. But this city over here of Narbonne was a strong Arab fortress and remained in their hands after that. When Charles died, in 741, the rule passed to his son Pippin III, who's known in the history as Pippin the Short, so I guess he was. The death of so strong a ruler as Charles Martel, over who had controlled a lot of territory, meant that there were rebellions that broke out immediately, and Pippin spent about the next 20 years subduing and conquering more and more territory. These are called, by the way, the Carolingian kings, from the name Charles, which is Carolus in Latin. No Christian empire, no Christian kingdom other than that of the Franks controlled as much territory of anyone since the time of the Romans. So powerful had they become that by 755 there was an appeal from the Pope done in Rome that these Lombards were getting too close, and so Pippin was asked to send troops. He came across the Alps, he fought a battle against the Lombards at Pavia and beat them and saved the papacy therefore from conquest. When he died in 768, he left the kingdom to two of his sons. The youngest was called Carloman, and he died shortly thereafter. But the second and the oldest was also named Charles, and he's come to history as Charles the Great or Charlemagne. A picture. Carolus Magnus. Okay, Charles the Great. Now, Charles spent several decades moving back and forth between what is now Italy and what is now Germany, fighting the Lombards and then the Saxons, back and forth. He would be in Italy fighting the Saxons, and the Lombards would revolt. In Italy fighting the Lombards, the Saxons would revolt. He'd go to Germany to fight the Saxons, the Lombards would revolt, back and forth, back and forth. However, the Lombards had a king, and they had settlements, serious settlements, and so one good solid battle and victory would subdue them, and he did that. The Saxons, on the other hand, had no kings, and they had no settlements, they just had sort of extended family homesteads, and quashing them took a longer time. Of course, the Romans knew that from the time of Augustus, so it was not any new discovery. But by 774, the Lombards had been quashed, and Charles took the title of King of the Lombards as well as King of the Franks. And by 785, he had conquered and quashed the rebellions of the Saxons, and they then became much calmer because they were converted to Christianity. So Charles turned his attention to Bavaria and conquered that as well. And you can see in this red line the territory that eventually was the Frankish kingdom, and it is much of Europe today. On Christmas Day in 795, the English Pope Hadrian died, and he was replaced by Leo III. Leo III is regarded by history as probably the shiftiest of all popes. However, he's also been canonized by the church, so obviously there's a variety of opinions about that man. But by his time, there was a lot of money and power in the church. And so the position of Pope was very important because it was powerful and it controlled a lot of wealth. And so he had enemies, and they accused him of all kinds of things, of fornication, of perjury, of theft, I mean, you name it, and he was guilty. And eventually in 799, his enemies seized him and they blinded him and cut out his tongue, which was not uncommon punishment for your enemies in those days. They were a fairly difficult bunch. Leo fled to the protection of Charles, And his enemies had done such a bad job of mutilating them that he recovered both his sight and his power of speech, which was considered miraculous, and that's what led to his canonization nearly 1,000 years later. Charles restored him to Rome and to the papacy, and on Christmas Day in 800, Leo crowned Charles as an emperor, thereby creating in 800 the Holy Roman Empire, which lasted until Napoleon's victory in Austerlitz in 1805. So this empire lasted 1,000 years. There aren't many that last that long, but there was a man in the last century who claimed he was going to create an empire that also lasted 1,000 years and lasted about 15, fortunately for us. The creation of the Holy Roman Empire, which was jokingly called neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, was created more by accident than on purpose, and it was an outcome largely of Roman and papal politics and did not seem to be the desire particularly of the Franks. Nonetheless, it had this enormous legacy, said by historians to be about the worst legacy ever passed down to successors. Administering so large an empire was made difficult by the fact that almost no one was literate in those days, not even all of the clergy who were supposed to be able to read and write. But that we have any records at all from this period is largely due to just a couple of people, in particular the scholar Einhard, who wrote The Life of Charlemagne, Vita Caroli Magni, in the 820s, and this is a treasure house of early medieval writing. There were other people who helped administer this large empire. In particular, there was an English deacon, Alcuin of York, who arrived in about 780 and died there in 804. And his letters to people are one of the great sources of what was going on. The problems of governing and administering so huge an area with peoples of such different cultures and histories and languages and laws was never satisfactorily solved. Charlemagne made the decision in 806 to divide his realm amongst his three sons, but two of them died shortly thereafter. And in 813, his surviving son, Louis, was crowned as the new emperor. Charlemagne lived another year, dying in 814, and the new emperor is known as Louis the Pious. I'm not sure that that's an apt title, but that's what he's called. History claims he made two grave mistakes. The first is he had himself recrowned as emperor by the Pope, who was at this time Stephen, who was his successor to Leo, who had just died. And this established a tradition of papal investiture of the Holy Roman Emperor, which has turned out to be not a very successful thing. The second was that he decided to, he was taken up with his own mortality, partly because his two brothers had just died, but also because he and his entourage were crossing a wooden bridge on their horses, of course, and it collapsed, nearly killing him. So he was frightened, and he decided in some year or other, to divide his territory up amongst his three sons. And what this did immediately was to create regional loyalties, just as the Tetrarchy under Rome had created regional loyalties, and that was a big problem because what you wanted was dedication to the empire and the emperor and not this part against that part and so forth. And it was complicated further when a fourth son was born. Louis dismissed a lot of Charlemagne's advisors, but a new one, whose name is Benedict of Anyang, who was a Visigothic bishop, was the one who declared that since they had all this territory, that all of the monasteries would be governed by the rules of Benedict. But the misrule of Louis resulted in coup attempts from between 830 and 840 when he died. He was exiled, brought back, back and forth like a yo-yo. And then, of course, as I say, he died in 840. There was chaos and struggle as sons and cousins and grandsons and nephews struggled, as my grandmother would say, the ganze Mishpucha. They struggled to see who was going to be the king. And there were people named Lothar and Charles the Bald and Louis the Second and Charles the Fat. All of these people, I guess these all were bald and fat and so forth. And the multiplicity of heirs could really only be conquered, solved, if they could conquer more territory, which they were not able to do. Now, in the beginning of the 10th century saw the decline of the Carolingian Empire, and especially in this eastern half, which is what we now call Germany. By 930, the western half also began to die out. And a preview of this had already been seen way back in 885. 885, when Paris was besieged by Viking raiders. This was the first recorded Viking raid we know of was back as far as 793, when the island monastery of Lindisfarne off the coast of Northumbria was sacked. And this was the first of numerous raids on Britain, on Ireland, on the Channel, the Atlantic coast, etc. We know very little about the Vikings themselves, because they never wrote anything. I'm not even sure they were literate. The reports we have are from those people they were busy killing, and so obviously they're not necessarily very straightforward. Even the name Viking is in some dispute. The word vík in Old Norse means an inlet or a bay, and there are still plenty of places in Scandinavia that are called víkin. Swedish Vikings traditionally went east into the Baltic here and then into Russia. Danish and Norwegian Vikings, generally, particularly Danish, went to England. The Norwegians tended to go places like Iceland. We don't know why they suddenly started these raids, whether it was ecological disaster, whether it was their ability to build better boats, whether there was overpopulation, who knows. In Russia, here, even the very name Russia may come from the Vikings, because the Swedish Vikings who went there came from an area in Sweden called Ruslagen, which is the area on the east coast between Stockholm and Uppsala. In any case, the Viking raids were marked by an extraordinary level of violence, even in those violent days. Wars between Christian communities were violent, of course, but monasteries and their possessions were considered sacrosanct. Not to the pagan Vikings, who saw these undefended places, monasteries that were full of precious metals and liturgical ornaments, as really sitting ducks, and they took advantage. The island of Iona was raided in 795, in 802, in 806, again in 807, and finally all the monks there left and went to Ireland for protection. The internal problems that the empire was undergoing led to the ease for the Vikings to reach places like Rouen down here and Nantes. And Boulogne. And by 844, the Vikings had sailed up Garonne, here, and had sacked Toulouse. They sailed to Galicia, and then down the coast sacked Lisbon, and then into the Mediterranean, sacking Seville. These were serious incursions. For example, in the siege of Paris, Charles the Bald paid the Vikings 7,000 pounds of silver to get rid of them. That's a lot of precious metal. These raids, as I said, were very significant. I used to think when I read about Vikings in the old days that there was a ship or two. They had as many as 600 ships and 10,000 warriors on them, sailing around that were raiding. So they were very serious. Not only did they look for ransom, but for gold and so forth, but they loved to capture slaves, because if they were rich, then you could get a ransom, and if they were poor, you could sell them off as slaves. And slaves were very important for household duties and for tilling the land. By the early 10th century, the entire valley of the Seine was in the hands of Vikings. They were well settled around Nantes and the edges of Brittany, and eventually in all of Normandy. In England, the Vikings were even more successful, having removed the Anglo-Saxons from Northumbria, from Mercia, from East Anglia, and it was only Alfred of Wessex who was able to stop and even occasionally beat them. Otherwise, England would be still speaking Danish to this day. However, by the 10th century, what had happened already in France here began to happen in England, as the populations started to merge and the Vikings and the native populations started to become one. The Viking influence can still be seen strongly in Yorkshire, where there are a tremendous number of Scandinavian words still in the local dialect. But this amalgamation of populations led to the Danish Vikings adopting Christianity. The Swedes, who went east and conquered Kiev and sailed down the great the Dnieper River and the other river, big rivers in Russia, came into contact with the Byzantines, and that led them too to adopt Christianity. And the Norwegian Vikings adopted Christianity largely through contact with their Danish cousins. The western half of this empire, as it was of course under siege from the Vikings. The eastern half under siege from the Avars here, and particularly the Avar Empire here began to collapse as they were pushed by yet another nomadic tribe that had come from the steppes of Central Asia, called the Magyars. And these in the Frankish chronicle are not called Magyars, they're called Ungari. So that's where the name Hungarian comes from. Now, to go back to medieval science, this rested primarily on Pliny's Natural History. Pliny was a Roman who lived from 23 to 79 in the Common Era, so his work was quite old by this time. However, it was the largest known collection of facts, ranging from cosmology through geography and zoology and botany and agriculture, etc., medicine, even covered the fine arts. Until the rediscovery of Greek text in the 12th century, this was the greatest source of knowledge. In Northumbria, at the Lindisfarne Monastery, lived in the Venerable Bede, as he is called, and he lived from 673 to 735, and he wrote a very famous treatise called De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things. He purposely adopted the title that had been used by the Roman Lucretius about 50 BC, on the nature of things. And I've actually read that book. It's about 150 pages long, so it's short, and it's about the nature of things, and it goes from cosmology to animal reproduction, and it's all there in 150 pages. He was a good writer, I think. Bede combined Pliny's writings with the works of Isidore of Seville, but he was much more sophisticated than Isidore, who said, for example, that the earth was a wheel on which we lived on the rim. Bede said, in fact, that the earth was a stationary sphere. It had five zones of it, only two of which had temperate climates and so could be habitable. And we only lived in the north because you couldn't live in the south, otherwise you'd have to stand on your head all the time. And if you look at the moon in the southern hemisphere, you are standing on your head relative to the northern hemisphere. It works just backwards. Now, Bede also said that the heavens There were seven heavens surrounding the earth. They were air, ether, Olympus, fiery space, the firmament with all the heavenly bodies, the heaven of the angels, and finally the seventh heaven, that of the Trinity. And we get the title of the seventh heaven from Mr. Bede. He also understood that stars made circular motions, but that planets needed epicycles to describe them. In Bede's time, there were significant calendar problems. The calendar was a troublesome curse to Christianity for centuries because of the need to date Easter. By the 4th century, and when there was still some contact with Greek knowledge, the century-old discovery that the solar and lunar calendars, which are quite different, would coincide after a period of 19 years. This is something I will talk about on Saturday. This was rediscovered and led to a better calculations of the date of Easter. But still, the distances from Jerusalem to Alexandria to Rome to Ireland meant that people celebrated Easter at different times, and that was not acceptable. By 703, Bede was able to correct much of these errors, and his work remained a systematic accounting for the calculation of the date of Easter for many centuries. When Alcuin of York went to work for Charlemagne, he took Bede's work with him, and Bede's book was very significant science for his time. Now, the idea of pilgrimages is something that's deeply ingrained in Christianity. In the very earliest days of Christianity, there were no pilgrimages. That great doctor of the church, St. Jerome, moved to Bethlehem back in 386, and this led to people coming to visit him. Augustine did not consider a pilgrimage to be anything important, but Jerome said that walking in Jerusalem in the footsteps of Christ was an act of faith. And this view prevailed, and by the middle of the 5th century, many people made the difficult trip to Jerusalem, first from Constantinople, but even a few people from as far away as Western Europe. However, the Arab conquests and the Arab navy and eventually various pirates stopped pilgrimages basically entirely, and it wasn't until about the 10th century, when the Byzantine navy had control of the eastern Mediterranean again, that pilgrimages to Jerusalem started. But by that time, there were four major pilgrimage sites. There was Santiago de Compostela in Spain, and that's where the remains of the apostle James were supposed to be found, after Santiago is James in Spanish. There was Monte Gargano in the south of Italy, Apulia, where the Archangel Michael was said to have made an appearance. There were the sites of Rome, and of course, most important of all, there was Jerusalem. The founding of a monastery at Cluny, which is down here somewhere, in 910, made a big difference for pilgrimages. Where did I get? I left that one out. Sorry. Anyway, there is the a drawing of the Abbey of Cluny, and this is a Benedictine monastery, and they established priories throughout, mostly throughout what is now France. And the purpose of all of these was to aid pilgrims on their way to Santiago. This church, which is was the largest church in Christendom from 11th century to the 16th century, the reason I have a drawing rather than a picture is that it was totally destroyed during the revolution in 1790-something or other. But just for completeness, here is the present-day cathedral at Santiago de Compostela, a very lovely church, and still the site of pilgrimages to this day. By the 11th century, the Carolingian Empire was really finished, and there was a new order in the West. There were no more depredations from Huns or Vikings. Things were much more peaceful. However, peasant life changed, but it didn't get any better. Nobles went from being warriors to being landowners, and the energy of the nobles went to squeezing profits from their land. And so serfs went from being soldiers under some lord to being serfs. And this is the beginning of the of serfdom in Europe, and a dreadfully difficult time for the poor. Farmers became the property of lords. Technology made better food supplies for people, but all the wealth of that and the good food went to the nobles and not to the peasants. Trading increased, and people on the edges of the empire found it useful, if they wanted to participate in the trade, not to join the European Union, but to accept Christianity. And so Poles and Hungarians and Slavs and Scandinavians all made choices between the Roman and the Byzantine Church. But the Church now started to pay some attention to the poor because of this change in society. There grew up villages and a series of village churches, to which the Church gave the name parroquia, which has been translated into English as parish. The parish was a territorial unit which could offer in principle pastoral care to the poor. But it also gave the Church a brand new way of getting money. That's called tithing. Tithing is a very ancient tradition. It's mentioned in Babylon in about 800 or 900 BCE, and is certainly recorded in the book of Genesis. It became a new source of wealth for the Church and, of course, for the nobles in the 11th and 12th centuries. And this had serious consequences for the Church, particularly in the area of sin. Serfdom and slavery were not considered sinful, but the possibilities of sinning from wealth became apparent. And so as sins multiplied, so did the means of absolving sin, and indulgences and pilgrimages became ways of absolving sin, eventually leading to the selling of indulgences for money, which is called simony, and this led eventually to part of the complaints of Martin Luther against the Church. But Dante himself reserved the eighth circle out of nine in hell for those convicted of simony, and that's pretty deep and nasty indeed. Now, the wealthy people could buy penance or they could go on pilgrimages, but not the poor. Their life of labor never gave them time to achieve any sort of penance for their sins. And so the Church needed to create for them a way of absolving their sin. And so this led to the creation of a middle state between heaven and hell in the 12th century, so that the mundane sins of the life of a peasant could be absolved. Penance could be done in this intermediate state, and it had only one exit, that towards heaven. It's, of course, called purgatory, and it became very popular in the West, but still was considered anathema in the East. The changes in the economy of the time led to greater violence, as lords either squeezed the peasants for more and more revenue, or they attacked their neighbors to try to increase their own holdings and their own wealth. And that, of course, led to the creation, to the building of these great castles that we still see throughout Europe as means of defense. There were also peace movements, appeal to consciences, and these were led both by kings, but also especially by the popes. And this began to increase the secular power of the popes, and it will turn out to be important. During the 11th and 12th centuries, the Church also sought to establish control over marriage. And thank you. Thanks. Over marriage and sexual behavior of human beings. The idea of the Church wedding became common, and it became a sacrament. And because it was a sacrament, divorce became impossible. In the early days of the Church, divorce was quite common. But now divorce became impossible except for this understanding that a marriage had never taken place. There is also new definitions of an incestuous union and limits on which relatives one could or could not marry. These added restrictions of the church led to the fact that there were fewer heirs born to wealthy people. And that meant that property could be left to the church when there was no heir, and so they became yet richer. When there were offspring, they didn't want to have the estate divided amongst the offspring because that would then dilute it so much that nobody would have anything. And so the whole idea of eldest takes all, primogeniture, became quite common. This was pretty tough on the younger, and this happened in the 12th century, but a lot easier than what happened in the 11th century when the eldest would castrate his younger brothers to prevent any conflict about inheritance. The laws of inheritance also led to a banning of clerical marriage. Higher clergy and monks had always been celibate, but now this was extended to all clergy. Celibacy set up a barrier between the laity and clergy, and it established a badge of holiness. And these changes were aided by the fact that these rather scandalous popes of the 9th, 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries were replaced by a much more serious and reasonable set of popes by 1046, when Clement II took over the papacy. These were now primarily German popes rather than the popes appointed from these Roman families who had all this tremendous internecine struggle. But as part of this, popes began to appoint bishops rather than kings and the emperor appointing bishops that had been the previous practice. And these changes led to considerable controversy between secular and clerical rulers, from the Guelphs and the Ghibellines that in Italy, from what we see in Dante's Divine Comedy, to rulers fighting in France and Germany. The Pope who brought all of this together was Gregory II, who reigned from 1073 to 85, and it's called the Great Gregorian Reform. The conflict between the church and the secular power in England is highlighted by the conflict between Henry II and Thomas Becket. So a conflict that started with the king's legal jurisdiction over the clergy led to the murder of Becket, the construction of a grand cathedral in Canterbury, the cult of pilgrimages to Canterbury, and the wealth of legends and literature, including the film with Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton, as probably not the highest of literary events, but still. The most significant event of this era was the schism and separation of the Eastern and Western churches. And this occurred in 1054, which was the last reign of Pope Leo IX. There were two issues. The first was a disagreement over the bread used at the Eucharist. The bread was becoming increasingly identified with the body of Christ. The West came to use unleavened bread, which had the advantage of not dropping into crumbs. The Greeks regarded this as yet another departure from early custom, and they even asked whether unleavened bread was bread at all. But the most serious breach occurred over the use of a single word, the Latin word filioque, which means from the Son. In the Creed, the Holy Spirit originates either from God in the Greek Church or from God and the Son in the Western Church. For the East and in Greek, I will read the words, and in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, from the Father proceeding. In the West and in Latin, and in the Holy Spirit, the Lord and giver of life, who from the Father and the Son proceeds. That difference has never yet been healed and resulted in the schism between Orthodox Christianity and Roman Catholicism, and it still exists. Now, Pope Leo sent his ally, Cardinal Humbert, to Constantinople to negotiate with the patriarch in 1054. Humbert had been a monk at Cluny, but he was now the Archbishop of Sicily. And Sicily was an island in deep contention between the Romans and the Byzantines, who were struggling over it. And he was apparently a very acerbic and not very nice man. And with a calculated rudeness, he came to Constantinople. He walked with his entourage into Hagia Sophia during a mass, walked up to the pulpit where the patriarch was officiating, laid on the pulpit a bull of excommunication from the Pope, turned around and stormed out, followed by people throwing things at him and booing and hissing, apparently. It was quite a thing. The increase of papal power meant an increasing need for bureaucracy, and so Urban II created cardinals, and then the College of Cardinals, the Curia, in 1089, and this, of course, has become permanent in church structure. The great change in philosophy, and I'll try to end soon, came from the contact between Franks and Arabs. The Arabs had obtained knowledge from of the Greeks from their conquest of Persia and then their contact with the Nestorian Christians who lived on the Gulf side of what is now Iran. The Nestorians, when Nestorius was exiled, took his Syriac-speaking followers, and they took these Greek texts. They had some of them in Greek, some of them which they translated into Syriac. But when the Arabs conquered that region, they got control of this information. And this was then passed to the Christians in the 11th and 12th centuries. And that change distinguishes the so-called Dark and Early Middle Ages from the Late Middle Ages, and it can be seen in many places and many people. The widely traveled 12th century English scholar Adelard of Bath has recorded, written a book called Natural Questions, Questiones Naturales, in which he records a conversation with his stay-at-home nephew. And he discusses in there meteorology and light and sound and botany, all things he learned in the East. This change, which is sometimes called the Renaissance of the 12th century, starts in France with Rosellinus, and we know of his writings only through his most famous pupil, who is Peter Abelard, and we'll talk more about him tomorrow, almost an exact contemporary of Adelard of Bath. The rediscovery of Aristotle by the West really started when the Christians conquered Toledo with its great libraries in 1085. And finally, in the 10th and 11th centuries, the church was very much under the control of the clergy, but lay folk wanted greater participation in their own salvation, and this is seen in the growth of pilgrimages and crusades and monasticism. The church, with its newly, had a hard time in this new adapting to these changes, and this led to quarrels, and it led to labeling many of the quarrels as clergy as heresies, and so much so that by 1022, King Robert II of France set a precedent for the church by returning to the ancient Roman tradition of burning heretics at the stake, and that has lasted for a long time. Cathedrals began to replace monasteries as centers of European culture as architects learned and builders learned new techniques. Schools became attached to these buildings to explore the problems and questions which all this new knowledge brought. These explorations were given the name theology by Peter Abelard, and that's the beginning of theology as we know it. In France, such schools remained attached to the church, but in Italy, which had larger and richer cities, they were quite independent of the church. And the first of these schools, this represents the beginning of Christian universities. And The first, the oldest of these was founded in Bologna in 1088, and the schools in Italy were not under the control of the church, but Bologna kept its independent nature by specializing on law rather than in theology. The University of Paris, formed shortly thereafter, specialized in developed from the cathedral school at Notre Dame, and specialized in theology, became the leading center of theological study in the 12th century, as we shall see. It later became called the Sorbonne, after its, the founder of a college by Roger de Sorbonne in 1257. These institutions thrived on the new knowledge of Aristotle. The Crusades added to the knowledge of Aristotle from Toledo. That must surely be one of the few positive benefits from those disastrous campaigns. The debate was partly fueled by Arab and Jewish thinkers such as Averroes and Maimonides, largely from the Spanish city of Cordoba, and that is something that would lead to future heresies, as we shall see. And that's enough for today, but tomorrow, we will really do hard stuff, because I'm going to start. I'm going to start with Aristotle and Aristotle's categories and the difference between substance and accident, and that's taken me a long time to figure out. So I'm sure 5 or 10 minutes will be expert at it. Thank you very much.